CliffCentral.com. So I went to this festival over the weekend. Talk about music, because music means a lot to me. I love it. I have so much that I've always loved and has a big influence on me. And I know it's just, I'm just not the right audience for these kind of things, but you get these music festivals with EDM, electronic dance music, MMD, LSD, EDM, they're all the right acronyms. But it's just so monotonous and so boring. I get it in life. You have vibes, you have situations, you have moods, you have things that are created for a certain reason. And of course, drug taking is a unique thing, ultimately. I think you need certain beats and that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm not a big drug taker. I'm not saying I've taken some drugs, but not a lot. Very little, actually. Seldom. Never needed it. But the music at this place was so monotonous. It was, like, so boring. So boring. So it's a beautiful outside area. It was a great location. All things considered, everything was there for a good day. Just think, like, every one of these DJs got up there. They had to play for an hour. Are you telling me, out of all of the world, I mean, music's been around since a Tyrannosaurus Rex ate a Triceratops, you know, the rhythmic sound of its gut-wrenching screams before death with a smoldering volcano created some sort of a beat. It's been around since we've had ears, and these DJs rock up with the most monotonous shit, and they all dance to behind the decks like they're Calvin Harris, but they are just so boring.
And it's the same. It could have been 10 years ago.
It could have been.
Yeah.
It could have been. And we just become so used to monotony and average in this world. And it's like, yeah, he's rocking it. No, he's fucking average. And it just seemed like there's so many different ways to have fun. And music is just the most incredible thing. If we were there, and if this was an origami thing, and people were folding paper in a certain way, got it. Because you've got paper, and you've got paper. This is music. Music is endless. Music is an infinite thing, which just goes on forever and ever, and there's different sort of inspirations, and there's vocals, and there's instruments, and there's melodies, and there's rhythms, and there's everything. And all it was dum, 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 dum. And, like, you just look around and go, fuck, you know, you actually got to be on drugs, otherwise what's the point? What's the use?
Did they look like they were having a good time?
As Mac Miller would say, what's the use? Yeah, sure. I mean, when you pay the money and you go out, you got to have a good time. You got to have a good time.
Look, DJs these days are just, I don't know, it just depends on who they are and what their vibe is, but...
Spot on.
They follow what the audience also does.
No.
No?
You're right in the first half. It's them. These guys are having a party. You look at the dance floor. People are just like milling around a bit. But then you get Calvin No Fucking Harris over here jumping around, going, giving it the big one with his very dark sunglasses on. I think, dude, you've got to be more connected with your audience. Like, throw a bit of variety out there. There's people sitting down. There's people walking around. I get to... Anyway.
It wasn't for you?
Not for me.
Perhaps the music wasn't... This type of festival wasn't for you. Maybe you needed the Starlight Classic.
You needed the Starlight Classic. That's what I think.
Well, again, we're talking about variety. The thing is, it's like, it's so easy to say, well, Ben, it's not for you. And I will accept that. And I shall walk away from this conversation totally happy. Mm. But as someone who has DJed a long time ago, who understands music.
DJ Ben Curry? Yeah,
people lost their shit when I was DJing. Yeah. I had fun. I've had way more fun than they had fun. But anyway, my whole point is that music is the most beautiful thing out there. It transcends all kinds of barriers, race, religion, whatever, whatever. Music is a part of everyone's life, and there's so much of it. And to think you go to these festivals and you hear the same kind of shit over and over and over, and it's not that great. It's not like, I mean, if it's really great, I got it. Keep playing it. Don't mess it up a good thing. But I don't think it was. Yeah, so it's Monday. It's the 17th of September. If you missed us in the first hour, well, shame on you. It was a good hour. Got through a lot of things, and we informed you about what's happening in the world right now. And more importantly, what is going to something of news to share with other peoples.
Mm-hmm. What? Please read.
Something to gain of something news to share with other peoples.
On a day like today. Yeah. Hurricane Florence.
Yes.
Is she still causing havoc?
Still causing havoc.
Because that was a big story.
North Carolina.
Did you see that there was this great meme? Someone walks into Donald Trump's office. There was actually a cartoon. And said, Mr. President, Florence is causing all kinds of havoc. Hurricane Flores is causing all kind of havoc, and Donald Trump responds by saying, just give her the same deal that you have Stormy Daniels.
Oh, wow.
Oh, no, but it's still going on, and something that always catches my eye is the animal rescues that take place during this sort of thing.
So we find out where the really good humans are.
Yeah, and there's a journalist out there. His name is Andrew Carter. He's with the Charlotte Observer. Mm-hmm. And his Twitter page, he's collated a whole lot of stories of animal rescues. And it really is heartwarming how people just stop what they're doing and dive in there, literally, to save these animals. There's one image in particular that was captured by a News Observer with a guy named Robert Simmons Jr. and his little kitten Survivor. I've just tweeted the picture now, so you'll be able to see it.
Oh, adorable.
But it's just so sweet. Richard Simmons is in a boat being rescued, and he's got this...
As middle-aged housewives would say, I'm finished.
Yeah, I'm finished. This sopping wet little sad tiny kitten on his shoulder. And the two of them just look really, really forlorn. Apparently the reporter was with this guy and chatting away to him, and then the little kitten emerged from out of his wet jacket. Just if you do want to have a look at some of these amazing rescue stories, there are a couple of animal shelters that have been flooded, and people have literally stopped what they're doing to carry these animals onto buses and into cars and get them out of the area. That's what's happening with Hurricane Florida, and obviously we can't stop watching these disasters.
It's Hurricane Florence.
Sorry, yeah. Hurricane Florida.
Hurricane Florida, that's a big hurricane.
I think this past weekend, people have now finally been taking it seriously. People who live in Florida and those regions, and they've been listening to what the authorities have been saying for the longest time, because I guess I've been trying to put myself in their shoes, the people who have to evacuate and they leave their homes and their belongings and, but I don't understand why you need to put up a fight. This is for your own safety, you know? Have you been seeing the stories of people who have been...
They just won't move.
Yeah, they've been staying in their houses, not budging at all.
No, they're waiting for Jesus. Mm. We all know that joke.
And, you know, there are a lot of these hurricanes that come and go, and so we do tend to become a bit sensitized, or desensitized rather, and there's a reason for that. And there's also a reason why we keep on watching these disasters unfold on TV.
Yeah, you're right, Leanne. There's the whole car crash kind of mechanism. We can't help it. We just want to see disaster. Like, I know 9/11 obviously was last week. People obviously sharing all the things. I mean, I've seen fresh footage of the planes hitting the buildings I've never seen. Did I watch it? Of course I did.
Yeah.
Did I watch it again? It's not important. Sorry, Mac Miller still wants to be part of the show.
Did you hear what happened in Sandton last week on 9/11?
Get to it in a second, Sierra. I'm just going to give you the science of Leanne's very salient point here.
There's something about disaster and destruction that has a tendency to draw an audience. High ratings for TV coverage of a plane crash, rubbernecking at a car accident, viral photos of a hurricane's aftermath. These images are devastating, saddening, and sometimes scary. But watching all of this bad news can actually be positive for the brain. This is Your Brain On, where we explore how the world affects our brains and ourselves. When you witness disaster, even when it doesn't happen to you, your brain goes into survival mode. The images and information you receive stimulate the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that manages emotions and survival instincts. The amygdala then sends signals to your frontal cortex, which is involved in analyzing and interpreting information as well as regulating your judgment. This process triggers the fight or flight response, and some people crave that adrenaline rush or that intensely heightened emotional state, even though it's actually negative. Going through these mental motions can be upsetting, but it also helps to train the brain. You collect data about dangers and how you might avoid them. You also get the chance to face scary situations and think about how you'd respond without any actual physical risk. But at a certain point, the scale tips into voyeurism. And if you watch too much disaster coverage, you could be desensitized, adversely affecting your mental health. A meta-analysis of studies considered the effect of media viewing of disasters such as the September 11th attacks and the Oklahoma City bombing. It concluded that consuming TV coverage was linked to PTSD, depression, anxiety, and stress. Disasters happen, and it's important to learn about them. But if you find yourself sad or stressed, consider limiting yourself to only watching for a short amount of time. You may also feel better if you take action to help victims. Research shows that volunteering can boost functions related to the release of oxytocin. That hormone not only makes you feel great in the moment, but also helps you manage stressful situations, which comes in handy if disaster strikes.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, so we actually get to have like a little practice session in our own minds of how we would tackle this emergency and how we would behave.
But what a great point about the whole voyeurism thing, though, because unfortunately that's what we've become, because we have so much at our disposal. I mean, we're surrounded by screens. I've got 4 screens right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at you guys. I'm looking through another window. Voyeur the hell out of this. But it is. And then it's the whole thing about balance. But, you know, if we want to be... Because obviously the lives that we lead are so different from our primal lives. Mm-hmm. So that we do become desensitized. We become quite fat, lazy, and just pretty much useless. So these things are good to have in our brain. But as the video ended there, let's apply it. Apply it to being, you know, helping out people and doing what we can.
Yeah, that's it. Well, from highly stressful situations to absolutely de-stressing situations,
mm-hmm.
It's being dubbed the most jaw-dropping airport lounge in the world. It's the brand new Air France business lounge at Paris Charles de Gaulle Airport. And look, looking at the first few pictures that I saw of it, it looks like a retro movie set. It is absolutely breathtaking. But it goes beyond that. It's got these sort of light therapy spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Well, firstly, the light around you mimics the weather outside. So it's all about keeping your body constant and overcoming jet lag and that sort of thing.
Travel can be traumatic. Oh.
Yeah. So, for instance, in this light therapy space, there are these changing, rejuvenating lights in this dome above your head, and you lie back on these lounges. Of course, the spa treatments are absolutely amazing. They've got detox juices and Finnish saunas, proper stone tiled showers, and spas for facials and all of these sorts of things, and a skin analysis, it takes your sleeping needs very seriously. So 50% of travelers visiting the business lounge have connecting flights. And that's why they are dedicated different areas for this purpose: the relaxation area, soothing atmosphere, and a detox bar that fits in with the trains. But then looking at it a little more deeply, you know, a lot of airport lounges that I've seen are completely boring. Whereas if you look at the slow lounge, for instance, that was really quite something in terms of design and modernizing the whole concept. And we've actually been quite spoiled by it, because I'm not that amazed by the aesthetics of this airport lounge.
No, you're so right. A lot of it, unless you get there's some brands that have taken it a little bit further, but generally lounges are very basic.
Mm.
Very basic.
Yeah. So, yeah. Anyone heard about the Volkswagen Beetle?
It's they're not doing it anymore.
Yeah.
It's finally coming to an end.
It is, and Twitter has apparently fallen apart. Bug lovers are shedding tears on Twitter.
Okay, we kind of touched on this last week,
and
we all were kind of unanimous in that, well, no one's really going to be upset, because who actually cares about the new Beetle? No one's cared about the new Beetle. Like, when Mini became new, it got a whole new life and a whole new chapter. Beetle, though, was like... Yeah.
And in America specifically... you know, the trend has always been bigger and better there, and obviously SUVs and all of that are the rage. And then there was a slight trend towards buying European styled cars, your cute little Fiats and things like that. But it's fallen dramatically again, and drivers are increasingly turning to larger cars and SUVs.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's pretty sad.
Sorry, sir, you were saying there was a catastrophe in Sandton last week?
No, it was just very odd, and I'm not one to rile people up based on just coincidence or conspiracy. But 9/11, there was a bomb scare in the middle of Sandton last week.
I did actually see a tweet about this.
This was the second bomb scare in a while. one previously a few weeks ago happened in Pretoria, and I was actually speaking to a friend of mine who is, I wish I knew her job title to justify more of this, but she works for a financing company, and she's essentially hired to look at where foreign investors are investing in South Africa. And so she always has to look at the landscape of South Africa to assure the investors, like, okay, no, this is something to worry about. This isn't something to worry about. So something like bomb scares and a trend of bomb scares popping up is sadly something that we have to be concerned about. But yeah, 9/11 last week Tuesday, there was this bomb scare in the middle of Sandton, and the CBD was shut down for a while. It was the West Street in Sandton, which, if you're unfamiliar with Sandton, is a very popular street. And yeah, people in those office buildings had to actually evacuate for a while. The K9 unit was actually sent in, and they did find a bomb in the building. But this is what is it's very odd and scary in this way. What is further scary, and this is what my friend pointed out, and once again, not to incite commotion for no reason, but she actually let me know that South Africa doesn't have a full-on bomb unit.
Might we sell it to someone?
I don't know. We don't have a dedicated bomb unit because, I don't know, I guess we never had bomb scares or bombs going off as a
apartheid
concern.
And anti-apartheid, we certainly did have those concerns. And realistically, you look at the SABC, I remember one of the first things I noticed was this big bomb wall that was built around the studios. So that's really interesting that
What's a bomb wall?
It's like a protective wall so that it doesn't shake the building to its foundations.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
But you look at, in this case, the fact that the K9 units had to be called to sweep and. But, yeah, I just thought it was very odd and scary that on 9/11 there was a bomb scare. It might have just been a coincidence. Who knows? It might just be a scorned employee of one of the buildings who wants to prove a point. But thankfully, nothing happened. Thankfully, everyone is safe. But, yeah, just very, very odd.
But who calls a bomb scare? I mean, oh gosh. I think you should just go straight to an incinerator. Because, I mean, it's so inconvenient for people. We could leave the building.
You see, the reason why, for me, it's extra scary is the fact that there was an actual bomb found. If it was just a bomb scare and that was it, because someone could be crying wolf all the time.
Yeah, sorry.
Or someone could have been trying to prove a point and was just nothing. But a physical bomb was found, something to pay attention to. Anyway, let's just pay attention to a different thing, something that will make us roll our eyes in a different way. Suni Priven, probably a name, that doesn't ring a bell right now, but I'll tell you her story and you'll go, ah, that one. Suni Priven, remember her? She is married to Woody Allen, and she was adopted by Woody Allen and her...
Ah,
and
his, that's one.
That
yeah.
one.
Yeah, there we go.
Yes. Suni's married to Woody Allen, but years ago was actually adopted by Woody Allen and his then wife, Mia Farrow. But when their marriage broke down between Mia and Woody, I don't know, Suni and Woody one day looked into each other's eyes.
Well, it probably broke down because Woody was looking into her eyes. Woody, that's meant to be our daughter. Yeah, I thought that.
So many years have gone by, but it still just sends this weird shiver down my spine.
Of course, it's creepy.
Suni is now standing up in the midst of all of these the Me Too movements coming out, and so many people coming out and speaking out against certain people. Particularly Mia is speaking out very frankly around Woody Allen. Well, Suni is like, not on my watch, you are not going to speak badly about my husband. Suni is now 47 years old and is still married to her, do you say former father?
Ex-father.
Ex-father. father, current husband, 82-year-old Woody Allen, and is actually saying that Mia is speaking out, frankly, because she is jealous of their relationship, and saying that from the get-go, when she was adopted into the family, Mia was never fond of Suni, saying, and I quote here, that the actress, Mia Farrow, was an abusive tyrant who beat her with hairbrushes, called her moron, and would hold her upside down because she thought that blood going to my head would make me smarter or something.
That's, well,
one bizarre family.
There's a lot happening there.
Words you think are suitable for this.
I just think her only way out was probably to marry Woody.
Mm. She says it is not her intention to go off on Mia and sound bitter, but she thinks that the time is right for her to speak out because she believes Mia Farrow is trying to manipulate the Me Too movement to exact her twisted payback against Woody Allen and her. She says that as well, while she was initially adopted at 6 years old, Mia was never maternal or caring towards her. One of the first memories she had.
Wait, hang on. She was adopted at 6 years old.
Yes.
Does that make the story creepier or less creepy?
I mean, the story's already creepy.
I know, but I mean, there's levels here. Like, if they adopted her at maybe like 17, does that make it less or more creepy? I'm just trying to work this out. Because if you adopt someone at six, that whole father, maybe child.
Yeah, it does
make
it creepier.
I think it does definitely make it creepier.
If you were 17, it's like, okay, well, you are a stranger, but you look like a young adult, and, you know, perhaps I'll find you
creepy adult
attractive on those grounds. But if you're 6 years old and you grow up in front of my eyes, just very weird. But Suni says one of the first memories she remembers of her and Mia was the first couple of nights at her new adoptive home, and Mia just threw her into the bath. These are her words, saying physically threw her into the bath, not caring whether she was safe or not, and ever since then was just very off and weird between her and Mia. But yeah, so Suni standing up for her husband, 82-year-old Woody Allen.
Hmm.
Oh, she's got to get something out of that, Will. Can't blame her. Going away from creepy to kind of more exciting in the entertainment industry, Joseph Clark is here. Well, he's not here. I mean, he's outside. He's having a cup of coffee, I think. So we're going to bring him in. And this guy's bio, resume, Sia was just touching on it. But yeah, I mean, this is a proper performer. This guy has got all the sort of attributes and still touring, still loving what he does, clearly. So while we get him in here, because, you know, the distance between where our guest is and the studio.
So far. Very far.
Our studios are so vast and lavish. They really are. They're quite something.
Rolling passages.
I went onto YouTube and I found this. Joseph Clark, the music of Queen.
Ooh.
2016. Told you had good legs.
I want to break free. I want to break free. I want to break free from your lies. You're so self-satisfied. I don't need you.
We all want to break free from the stresses and strains of everyday life, Leanne.
Oh, yes.
Are you stressed? You need a break of the daily grind?
I'm just not stressed.
Okay, well, other people are. So yes. if you are stressed and you need a break from the daily grind, how about a manicure, a pedicure, massage, or a hair treatment? Escape to an award-winning day spa in the heart of Rivonia, Johannesburg. It's our hood. Skin Sense Day Spa hosts a comprehensive range of expert beauty treatments for women and the men. What are you looking for? And however much or little precious me time you have, you'll find your perfect solution at Skin Sense Day Spa. Find out what this month's specials are at cliffcentral.com. Very good website, that. All of our stuff that we do here goes straight to there, Leanne.
Podcasts,
competitions, feature podcasts, what you can do at Skin Sense. It's all really, really happening right there. cliffcentral.com. If you're not listening to us live on that, or you're listening via the app, you can always go back. But today we have Joseph Clark in studio with us. He is the man you're about to hear right now.
Good morning.
Hi, Joseph. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you.
You were born in America.
I was.
How long were you there for?
Actually, not America, Texas. It's a, it's a different thing.
It's the Lone Star State.
Yeah, it's the Lone Star State.
Ah, okay. So that was you for a while, or was it one of those you were kind of like born there, then moved away relatively quickly?
I moved away from Amarillo when I was 20. So I was born and raised there.
Now, we often get guests, and I always wonder when where they were born, it gets thrown up quite quickly because they generally say it sounds interesting. But then I look at the rest of everything you've done, and that's not you at all. In the first hour, we're talking about ballet, we're talking about dance. We're getting straight into this here. What made you start that? Because in Texas as well.
I know. It's bizarre, isn't it?
You didn't have a lot of male contemporary ballerina friends,
one of my best friends that I was on the wrestling team with in my high school wrestling team was a dancer. That was one of the things that I kind of got into it. The main thing was I'd always wanted to be an actor when I was a kid. I wanted to be a movie actor. And I grew up on the old MGM musicals because my mom loved them. And so, you know, Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly were the guys that I really wanted to be.
And well, it's just so easy to emulate them because they were so spectacular. It wasn't just that they were talented; there was this aura around them.
Exactly.
It really was like the golden time of being celebrity in show business.
It really was. And so when I started in high school, when I started doing, there was a very, very good drama class. So I started, you know, doing drama classes. And my teacher, a brilliant man, his name was Neil Hess. He was also a very, very good choreographer. And he had a small dance company. And he knew that I was very, very serious about being an actor. So he called me into his, I'll never forget it, he called me into his office one day and he said, you must get a dance training. Now, this was pre-Chorus Line. This was pre the dance musicals, you know, that had just, when Chorus Line kind of led the way, suddenly all these musicals started, you know, being highly, you know, dance-oriented. And he said, you should get a dance training, he says, because you can sing and you can, you know, you're learning to act now. You're a good actor, so you must take a dance class. And I said, well, you know, that's fine with me, you know, because, like I said, you know, I wanted to be like the next Gene Kelly.
Yeah, and it was the full package then.
So I started, but it was late. You know, I was 17 when I started dancing. So and then it was from there that this friend of mine, Mark Lanham, who was in Mr. Hess's, had a little professional dance company as well, and I would go in every Wednesday and do a theater dance class for him. And then after that, he had his professional dance company. He had their advanced class. And there was also a girl in that class that I was kind of very, very keen on.
All the elements. You've got the inspirational teacher.
Yes.
Yeah, there's the other guy that carries the
place. Her name was Sherry. And so I stayed behind. I asked him, could I watch and everything, and watched. And I spoke with Mark because we were on the wrestling team together and stuff. And then I got very, very interested in dance by fluke. I was singing in the choir before Mr. Hess did the only full high school production of The Nutcracker in the United States, using his dance company, using high school students, using the high school orchestra. It's never been done in the United States. He was the only one to do it, and it was a brilliant production.
What an incredible opportunity for someone of that age, because kids don't get exposed to that. They don't get a part of that.
Yeah, and they're literally a part of it. It's not as if a ballet company came into town and they get to go and see it. He was producing it with them, and I was singing in the choir before it, and I didn't know what it was, didn't know anything about it. And the last night, because it ran a full week. He did a full week of full houses in a 1,500 seat high school theater. Jesus. It was incredible.
It was really amazing.
So it was on the last night, and a friend of mine, and I said, you know, let's go and check this out. I want to see what this what this is all about? And he said, yeah, we knew an usherette. There was a girl there that said, oh, there's a couple of seats there. So we went in, we sat down, and the music curtain went up, and the music had done, dun, da, 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 and there was all these characters walking in and everything. And I was like, wow, this is cool. And then after about 5 minutes, it was going on, and then I punched him. His name was Bill Thornton. He was a good friend of mine. And I said, this is great, but I think we're sitting too far back because I can't hear a word they're saying. And he looked at me like what? And I said, no, I can't hear them. I can't hear what they're singing or they're saying. He says, they don't say anything. They don't say anything. It's a ballet. I said, what do you mean a ballet? He says, no, all they do is dance. And I'll just never forget thinking, what have I gotten myself into? You know, the next 2 hours, all I'm going to do. And by the time Act One was finished, I was sold. And the next day I went to Mr. Hess and I said, I have to start. I want to start ballet. Because in my mind as an actor, it was the purest form of acting. I understood who every character was. I knew the storyline. I knew all the people. I knew everything that was going on, and not one word was spoken. So I went to him and I said, you know, can I do this thing? He said, well, you know, it's quite late for you. You know, it's very good discipline. You know, it's a big discipline for your acting, this and that. And that's all he had to say to me was, you know, you probably won't do, you know. Yes. And then I threw myself into it. Yeah. Two years later, I was living in New York. After that, I was working with ballet companies, became a principal dancer. I danced every major role that any dancer could wear. I danced all over the world. It was, yeah.
Okay, you've just fast-forwarded a massive chunk there.
Yes.
I mean, because it is, your first impression is, well, there's no words, there's no expression, it's not obvious, but this is the beauty of dance. This is the whole thing. It is so expressive and a discipline, because anyone can think they can dance, but so much comes out of good dance. And you say, like, identifying with characters. Like, how difficult was it to get in the beginning? Or were you just, you were like, wow, actually, this is just me. I'm naturally good at this.
Yeah, I must have had some maybe physical affinity for it. I don't know, but I think
I'd imagine it's quite a difficult thing to teach. Like, if you've got an actor, you can say, right, you work on your pitch, you work on your dialogue, you work on expressions, that kind of stuff. But with you, I mean, it's like, what are they going to say? Like, get the left leg higher or squat deeper?
No, that's exactly what it is. Yeah, I think it's, you know, dance is the most incredible form of exercise. I mean, especially ballet. It's so disciplined. And I think that's what I liked about it, was that you could see immediately what needs to be done, you know, and then you work on that, and then you hone that and hone that. So it's the discipline was fantastic.
But it really was like the most amazing sort of non-obvious way to start what you were eventually going to get into. Not only had you picked up another quality, you picked up another take on where you were going.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, everything entertainment is performing arts, travel. So you said goodbye to the land of Texas.
Texas. Yeah.
And that was it. Like, now the world is your oyster.
Yeah, yeah, and it literally was. I mean, the traveling, I loved it. I loved the traveling. It was
like you were in Memphis, because for a lot of people, it's kind of daunting. I mean, obviously, your family gave you some support, or
they did. They did. You know, I think my dad was, you know, I mean, Texas is very much like South Africa. You know, they, you know, dancing. Can you make a living out of the dancing? You know, and people ask, you know, but what do you do for a living? And you say, well, that's what I do for. I'm a dancer. That's what I do. That's how I make my money. That's how I pay my rent. So I think he was a bit worried. And when he came to see one of my first productions with a ballet company that I was working with, you know, full time as a member of the Court of Ballet, he came and saw one of our performances. And after that, he was like, "This is fantastic." Well, you know, so he was. I think he was relieved. You know, the fact is, oh, it is a job.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you can actually make a living out of this. You know?
But the whole thing is, like, that's always the question. And we have people from various performing arts and they come in here. And yes, you can make a living. Will you is the next question. And you've got to keep working and working and working.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, you find even now, like, you've never stopped honing your craft with these kind of things, right?
You can't. Because yeah, you can't stop. You have to.
That's the whole beauty of this, too. So you've still got all these different elements. Now, from there, you went more into the more obvious performing, okay? So you can sing always with your choir start. But I mean, was it like a change of chapter for you, or was it just an evolution of all your elements?
A little bit of both. because I still always in my life wanted to be an actor, I thought, once I started kind of working as a professional dancer, I thought, well, I'll give it 5 years, because 5 years became another 5 years and another. But at that certain point, when I said, like I said earlier, I was very, very fortunate to be able to dance all the lead roles, you know, that ballet has to offer. And I thought, what was the point of kind of repeating that? You know, I've right. done that,
yeah.
and I enjoyed it, and I gave, you know, I gave what I could. It's not as if, you know, it's not as if I would have just, if I'd done Swan Lake again, I would have just like, well, I've done this before, because that's not me. I would always try to excel, always try to,
yeah.
like you said, hone, make it better. But I just thought, you know, I've done it, and I can contribute to the arts and also contribute to myself. You know, so yeah, I decided, okay, I've done that. It's good. I'm, you know, I loved my career. It changed me as a performing artist. It made me a better actor, a better singer. Mm. You know, so yeah, I decided to go on.
Now, obviously, like, stage has been a big part of your life. That's what I find so interesting, is that you get people who will only ever be on TV, they'll only be in movies, whatever, but then you get those people who always have a craving for the stage. Is it something that is always so different? Like, you go to different countries, and there's obviously different cultures towards entertainment, whether people are new to something or very knowledgeable about something.
Yes, yeah.
Like, I what are the best sort of countries that you've had in that respect that you've gone to and felt like, wow, this is, you feed so much off an audience?
Well, you know,
you have to say South Africa straight away.
Yeah, no, I'm going to say South Africa, because it's very, very interesting. Especially when it was a real eye opener for me to go to Europe as an American and also as a South African. So, because as I went to Europe through South Africa, through living here, I was, and very interesting to perform for audiences who, you know, and I don't want to discredit anything or anything, but to perform in front of knowledgeable audiences, because let's face it, our theater, our sense of theater is kind of from that that basis, and they embrace theater is. Theater, the arts is a right. part, an intricate part yeah. of their lives, and just going there for the first time, even before we performed, of people, like when we were there and rehearsing and everything, and people asking, oh, what do you do? You know, I'm a singer, and they go, oh, wow, you know, like they're like you become something. You know, it's quite special for them.
You're definitely revered, yeah.
Yeah. So to perform in front of audiences there is it's also great, but it's also quite daunting, because they're very knowledgeable. You know, so you have to be, you have to be at the top of your game. You have to be, you know, because they don't accept
sure.
Mediocrity.
And it's not probably the first time they've seen that show as well.
Like, yeah.
They might have seen different variations.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
That.
Exactly. You know, especially daunting to have seen Queen, you know, in those countries, because they've seen them. Mm. You know, they've seen them year after year after year after year. They grew up on them, seeing them live.
Yeah.
You know, so to be able to go there and to do a show and then react the way they do is just, yeah, it's extraordinary.
Well, it takes on to the next point. You are currently touring South Africa and Europe with internationally acclaimed production, Joseph Clark, the music of a Queen. Was this, like, how did this opportunity come about as well? Because if you are anything in music, or if you have ears, you would have appreciated Queen and what they've done. And the whole thing about Queen, why I love them so much, is that it wasn't just about the music. It was about just being the biggest thing out there. Like, from everything, the way that the music was done, you know, like, they were in such debt in the beginning. I mean, I'm of the opinion that they created so much great music because they had to try to get their way out of this, like a record deal. Yeah. But they had to have the best studio, the best sound, everything that was going to be the best from day one.
From day one.
Because before Freddie Mercury came around, the rest of them were doing bit part gigs here and there.
Yeah.
Freddie would obviously go and watch them and say, you know, you guys are great, blah, 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 but you need something special. You need me. And they're like, well, who the hell are you, you buck-tooth weirdo? And he was the one that really...
He was a groupie.
He was. He was yeah. basically an unemployed groupie. He was this skinny little guy. I mean, he must have been a strange sight. And he's what kind of said, look, it's got everything or nothing. And to take on this role, firstly, you've got to be quite brave. you have to be. Because, I mean, you've done a variety of things. Like you say, if you don't get Queen right, people are going to say, yeah, it's just another bit part thing.
Yeah.
So like, what made you want to do this? Just because it's Queen and you love Queen? Or just, was this like the biggest test for you?
It was actually by fluke. I was working in Durban in the late 80s and early 90s. And the late Jeffrey Sutherland was the producer-director of the NAPEC musicals department. And so I'd done some musicals with him, and he called me into his office one day and he says, I'm doing this concept musical based on Queen's music. It's going to be called Queen at the Opera. Do you know their music? And I said, well, not really. You know, I mean, being from Texas and everything, it was, you know, Queen wasn't, you know, I mean, I knew I could recognize Bohemian Rhapsody and Another One Bites the Dust and We Are the Champions because those were anthems, and, you know, that they were already doing at sporting events and everything. So I knew. And I said, no, but I'm, you know, I'm keen. Yeah, of course I'll do it, you know, because for one thing, I loved working with him. He was a great choreographer, great director. And I knew it would be a good show. So he said, okay, well, these are the songs you're going to do. Gave it to me on a cassette tape. There weren't even CDs at that time. He gave it to me on a cassette tape. And he said, go away and listen to these songs. These are the songs you're going to be doing, and then we'll start rehearsals, you know, in a couple of months. So I took that cassette, and I listened to it. And again, you know, I approached, even in my dance career, I approach everything as an actor.
Sure.
You know, I look at it and I approach, you know, what is the, you know, what is the inner thing going on here? What, you know, what is it saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I listened to this music and I was like, oh my goodness, you know, why, you know, what, where did, you know, how did I miss this?
Yeah.
Growing up in music, you know, because I've always loved music, you know, since I was a kid. And I just, so I just kept listening and listening, and then I would cross reference. I would go and get, if I saw like a record of theirs, I would get it and listen to some of their other music, and I just realized, wow, this is, you know, this is very, very unique. This is another group that is has made an artistic mark like the Beatles. You know, until the Beatles came along, it was just groups, and it was great music.
Yeah,
and,
just music.
You know, even the Led Zeppelins, the great supergroups, it was their music, you know. The Beatles came along and suddenly went, you know, we're going to kind of do our own thing now, you know.
Yeah. We're going to shift the goalposts. We're going to be more than the
yeah,
music.
Yeah, we're going to be more for the music. And Queen was like that right from the beginning. So when those four finally made it together, when Freddie joined him, and then they finally got John Deacon.
Yep.
When those four got together, their decision was, their global decision, wasn't just Freddie's decision, but their global decision was, we are going to do music our way. We're not going to let anybody tell us what to do. And I remember seeing an interview with Brian May just recently, a few years ago. And he said they were either the stupidest musicians in the business, or they were way ahead of their time, because he said even before they got a record contract, didn't matter. They said, this is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
And look what happened. You know, they literally, the Queen literally changed the recording industry.
But now, as you know, the Queen Bohemian Rhapsody, the movie's coming out.
Mm.
So, like, any Queen fan wants, anybody, you know, if you read the books or if you lived the band for who they are, when the movies come out, again, its expectations are huge. And again, it's because it's Queen.
Yeah.
What's your take on this? Firstly, it's obviously great there is a movie finally after all these years. I know Sacha Baron Cohen, we actually played an interview last year around, wanted to do the Freddie story, but he wanted to go, obviously, the more debaucherous side of Freddie and get it all together.
Yeah.
He put a lot of time and effort into it. Eventually, I think Brian May just said, look, we're not having the circus around us. These things may not have happened, whatever. We don't be remembered for this kind of stuff.
That's.
And, of course, Brian May, I mean, there was some sort of, I think one of Freddie's ex-boyfriends released a biography. He wrote a book about the whole thing. But he was very graphic in how Freddie passed away and his less flattering final moments.
Mm.
And he was ostracized by the brand because, obviously, this is the band. Because, you know, there's certain things you don't want to, you know, there's certain mystique you want to uphold.
Mm.
But now we've got this movie, by all counts, it's going to be quite something. I mean, obviously, they've been doing the talk show circuit for a couple of months now. Like, do you reckon they can do it justice? I mean, you must know people who know people who've got some things to say about it already.
I certainly hope they do. I mean, the film media is the best way to, you know, if I can kind of preface that, I do the Queen music in my own way. I never go out to try and imitate Freddie because right. because you can't really. Who can imitate a great artist? You know, really.
Not Adam Lambert.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. Yeah.
Came out of his mouth, not yours. Yeah. That's fine.
my respect for Queen and Freddie is the music that they produce because that's how I do the show. My tribute is to their music, the volume of music that they brought to it. And I don't agree with these kind of tribute because eventually it comes off making Freddie look a little bit. Do you know what I mean? They don't know Freddie, so yeah. They have to kind of incorporate things maybe in their kind of own interpretation and everything that I don't think kind of pays tribute to him.
True.
And after all, Queen was not just Freddie. You know, Queen with the four of them. The four of those four composer musicians are unequaled because
the whole thing was that all the big hits. It wasn't just Brian May. It wasn't just Freddie. Yeah, they all created the
hits. It's unprecedented. Yeah. No major rock group has had four members write individually number one hits. That's before they started conglomerating and saying, oh, well, let's just say that the song is by Queen. But before that, all four of them individually wrote number one hits. It's never been done before, which shows you how special they are. So now I've prefaced that. So it's very, very, it's going to be very interesting to see. Obviously, they've got a lot of resource. Mm-hmm. They've got a lot of resource. But as we were talking about earlier, it's going to be interesting for me to see because Freddie's no longer around. It's still going to be a life based on other people's perceptions of who he was.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And with it being obviously a mainstream hit, this isn't an art house movie. A lot of Freddie's life was art house. But
yeah,
because it's going to be a mainstream blockbuster hit, there's obviously a certain path it's going to take.
Mm.
But with it being so much time again, they've had so much time to about this and what journey they're going to take. And, of course, as you say, the resources. I mean, the catalogue of memories and interviews that must have been and gone through this. Wow. And then, obviously, the guy playing Freddie, I always forget his name.
Malik.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it was Rami Malek.
Yeah, Rami Malek, yeah.
So I think they found the right guy. I mean, there's a guy who just looks so interesting. Could definitely got that.
Yeah.
Joseph, where can we see you now that you are in the country? Where can we see you, find out more about you from going forward from here?
Well, I'm going to be doing on Sunday. I'm going to be doing...
Right, this Sunday.
Yeah, this Sunday on the Sun Arena. I'm doing a show with the Johannesburg Big Band.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's quite a nice departure for me. A big band is also something... Jazz is also something that I just love. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be doing a concert with them, and the Johannesburg Big Band is just, they're the most amazing. It's the best brass players in the country are going to be doing this, so it's going to be a lot of fun. That's Sunday. And then I've got another show coming up in October. It's called Gone Too Soon.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's going to be at the Lyric, which is at Gold Reef City.
Yep.
And that's with the Johannesburg Youth Orchestra. It's like their 20th year anniversary. Eddie Clayton. There's two shows there. It's a Saturday night, the 20th of October at 8, and then the next day, Sunday, is 2 o'clock. And that's going to be with Timothy Malloy and Marshawn from Jamali. Okay. And Johannesburg Youth Orchestra. And it's literally a tribute to, like, the artists that, you know, didn't kind of stay around as long as what we would have liked them to, the Bowies and the Michael Jackson, Whitney Houston. I think there's going to be a Freddie thing in there probably.
You must be an absolute hoot to have at a party.
Why?
Well, I mean, Sia breaks in the song all the time and no one asks him, but you know, they would actually ask you.
No, Joseph, really, if you ever needed an understudy, I'm really wet. Fantastic.
Okay, give me your phone. Let's get the details.
Not him.
Start doing my warm-ups now.
Sia, why must you always have the final say?
Okay, I'm done. I'm quiet. Joseph, thank you for stopping by.
Joseph, thanks so much for coming through. So, social media wise, where can we find you? Just in case people did miss that.
Well, I think you can. You know what? I'm not so very, very good. My wife's gonna kill me.
She's gonna
kill me because I'm not so good on social media. But I am.
They'll hashtag all the right things. Yeah, like gone too. Yeah, hashtag gone too soon.
Hashtag gone too soon. Or hashtag Joseph Clark Music of Queen. To find out more about Joburg big band and stuff. Yeah, Submarine as well.
Very nice. Have a great week. All the best for the performances. That is today's show done. There is no reality check today, but go on to YouTube, go on to Rich's YouTube channel, like I said earlier. We've got the Karen Zoid interview up next here.
Yeah, boy.
That is correct. All right.
Good stuff.
Thank you, Dan, for being here today.
I'll see you next Monday.
Always a pleasant sight to have you here. And to everyone else, have a great week and a great Monday.
Cliffcentral.com.